Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
Me llamo Ken Rudin.
Ken, we're going to talk about immigration in just a moment.
How'd I do?
I thought you sounded very much like a fellow who was trying to speak in Spanish,
and
but has, like, no clue how to sound as though one were
speaking in Spanish.
Spanish speaking.
Well, at least I wasn't deported.
You know why you weren't deported?
Why?
Because your parents brought you here through no fault of your own.
Actually, they put me down in a basket down the Hudson River, and got here. So it just seems to me that after a policy of 288,000 deportations, suddenly President Obama is now just turned around completely on his policy of deportations.
Yes, that's right. The Obama administration had been pursuing a pretty aggressive policy of deporting people
far more
who
so
are
than
in
the Bush
country
administration.
Illegally. That's right. But they had also been big supporters of something called the DREAM Act, which was a big Democratic bill that failed because of a Republican-led filibuster in the Senate. And the DREAM Act would have created a path to citizenship and ended the deportation of young people who are in this country who have gone to school, who have never been arrested.
Served in the military.
And were brought to this country by their parents. So in other words, they never committed an illegal act of actually crossing the border of their own volition. They were brought here by their parents. That was the DREAM Act. It failed in Congress. But the president has administratively, as an executive decision, decided to change the policy with respect to deporting people under the age of 16 who meet those criteria. Now, that doesn't make them citizens. They can't vote. But it does end their deportations, and that has made him a hero, among other places, at NALEO, which is the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials, meeting in Florida this week, and put a lot of pressure on his rival, Mitt Romney, to take some kind of position on what the president has done or on the DREAM Act itself.
Yeah, no, it's remarkable to me that when President Obama evolved into supporting same-sex marriages, that happened the week of a major gay fundraiser.
Well, so, of course, it was also the week of a major Joe Biden supposed blunder on the air when he committed himself to that policy and strongly implied the administration.
The Obama switch on deportations do come on a week where both Romney on Thursday and Obama on Friday, and of course we're doing the podcast before these two candidates speak before NALEO at Disney World. Now, political, yes, probably. The right thing to do, perhaps. But having said all that, it does put Romney in a very awkward position. First of all, you notice the Republicans have not responded the way they often do by saying it's blanket amnesty.
That's crazy. That's nuts.
They're
We're
not
against
doing that.
This. No. The leadership in the House and the Senate, the Republican leadership, has had very little to say
right.
about this.
I think one of the reasons is they're waiting for their putative leader of the party, Mitt Romney, to say something.
No, wait a minute. I thought he was Mormon.
No, he's putative.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But here's the problem. The problem, and we've said this all along, if Mitt Romney's political problems from the onset of his 2012 political career is that he's been accused of being a flip-flopper, how do you spend all this time and rhetoric during the debates trying to outdo the other candidates, certainly Rick Perry and Newt Gingrich, on the issues of deportation and illegal immigration, and suddenly say, well, you know, something the president is right on this?
Well, like last winter when he was asked, if you were the president of the United States and Congress passed the DREAM Act, what would you do? And this is what he said then.
The question is, if I were elected and Congress were to pass the DREAM Act, would I veto it? And the answer is yes. I'm delighted with the idea that people who come to this country and wish to serve in the military can be given a path to become permanent residents of this country. Those who serve in our military and fulfill those requirements, I respect and acknowledge that path. For those that come here illegally, the idea of giving them in-state tuition credits or other special benefits I find to be contrary to the idea of a nation of laws.
And now when you know the path to 270 electoral votes is in these states like Nevada, like Florida, like Colorado, like New Mexico.
And Virginia,
other states where the Latino vote is growing, how do you pivot? I mean, the problem with Mitt Romney has always been the accusation of constant pivoting. But whether what President Obama did was nakedly political or not, and maybe even if it was, he puts Romney in this difficult position.
I was surprised not only that the Republicans were quite so quiet, have been. They may still bring out the siege guns on this. But I was also surprised at some of the initial polling, which showed that the president's position regarding these youths, people under 16, law-abiding, et cetera, and non-deportation, was as popular as it seemed to be in the polls that we immediately saw. Now, one of the polls that said that it was quite a popular position, something like 60% support, was a Bloomberg News poll, normally a poll that we pay a fair amount of attention to and take seriously. That same polling group a few days later came out with an overall Obama versus Romney number that was
way out of line
with everybody else's polling, and showed Obama, in fact, with a double-digit lead, which nobody else has. Most every other poll has the race essentially dead even within the statistical margin of error, 2 or 3 points difference. And so for them to suddenly come out with that result suggests that maybe the sample they had when they said that the position on immigration was popular was similarly unrepresentative. And so maybe the position that the president has taken is not really going to help him as much as that suggested.
Whether it is or not, we're still talking about this is June, and it still leaves Mitt Romney with a dilemma of how to deal with this issue. Now, again, he is speaking at Naleo as we're taping this podcast on Thursday, and it's my understanding that he will talk mostly about the economy and jobs loss and how it's hurting the Latino community more so than the regular population.
Before we leave the subject of immigration and the president's new position with respect to these youths, I think we have to mention the Daily Caller incident. When the president was making his announcement changing his immigration policy regarding these youths.
In the Rose Garden.
Yes, where normally when he makes a statement, he takes questions. We had been told there would be no questions. And as a partial result of that, one of the reporters attending this statement from the Daily Caller, a conservative website.
Run by Tucker Carlson.
Well-known conservative personality. One of these guys stood up and threw a shoe at the president. No, actually, he didn't stand up and throw a shoe at the president. He just stood up and interrupted the president's statement to ask him a question.
Although if you looked at the president's face, it looked like a shoe had been thrown at him because he was visibly irritated. He said, look, let me finish my statement.
Before you ask your question. And then the reporter said, are you going to take questions? Which was, you know, pretty much sticking it to him. And this made the press corps enormously uneasy, uncomfortable, and embarrassed. Because here they were, you know, in their usual attitude, and they were obviously acceding to the president giving a statement without taking any questions about a very controversial issue.
This is a temporary stopgap measure that lets us focus our resources wisely while giving a degree of relief and hope to talented, driven, patriotic young people. It is the right thing to do. Excuse me, sir. It's not time for questions, sir. Not while I'm speaking.
At the same time, Tucker Carlson said, I applaud my reporter for doing that because we're not supposed to be the lackeys who sit there and the president decides whether he gets asked questions or not. But this did break tradition. It broke
etiquette
and Massachusetts and Vermont.
It did. It was the kind of thing that the White House Correspondents Association always tries to discourage because it values the access it gets to the president and fears that if it acts out or if any people who are the guests there at the White House act badly, that somehow that's going to lessen the already very limited access that reporters get in the White House now.
Now, in fairness, Neil Munro, the reporter who did the outburst, he said that he thought the president was ending his statement and he just wanted to get a question in before the president left. Whether you buy that or not is one thing, but the point is this is something that you rarely see. It actually, in a sense, it was the metaphor of a shoe being thrown at the president.
Well, you know, and another aspect of this, really, is the resistance that this Congress, or at least the Republican elements of this Congress, and many people in the media have had to other parts of the administration. For example, Eric Holder, the Attorney General, who has been a target throughout the administration, and there have been a number of ways in which the Justice Department has made that easy to do. Prosecutions that failed Roger Clemens' prosecution just in the last few days, failed prosecution of
John Edwards.
Ted Stevens case, which actually began and happened before Eric Holder was the AG. But all of this characterizes the Justice Department, and Eric Holder is the symbol of that department. And this week, we actually had the House Government Oversight Committee vote to hold Eric Holder in contempt of Congress. This is an extraordinarily rare step, and it's not unprecedented, but they were not getting the documents that they wanted with respect to this botched gun operation.
We're talking about Fast and Furious, where the United States was supposed to have monitored the sending of guns into Mexico and to track where they went, but ultimately some of them wound up in crimes where a border agent was killed.
Right. Mm-hmm. The dispute now, of course, is about emails and documents having to do with how the Justice Department responded once the investigation began, and the president has exerted executive privilege to keep those documents from being provided to Congress.
Right, and Darrell Issa, the Republican from California, is the chairman of the House Government Oversight Committee.
The clerk will report.
23 ayes, 17 noes.
The ayes have it. And a contempt report is reported to the House. Without objection, so ordered, the committee stands adjourned.
So we heard the vote, which was on party lines, no surprise.
Big shock.
The Democrats and the White House say this is a purely political act, trying to embarrass the administration, embarrass Attorney General Holder. The Republicans are saying, look, the Department of Justice has been holding back information regarding this botched investigation, and that's where the two parties stayed.
So the next step in this process is that the whole House will vote, and surely again along party lines, and the Republicans will prevail, and they will hold Eric Holder in contempt, and then the case will be referred to the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, who will decide whether or not to pursue some sort of a criminal prosecution of the Attorney General. Now, no one expects that that will actually happen, but this is an enormous gesture of disapprobation, to put it mildly, and the Republicans are having a field day with it. And they're also having a field day with a number of other vulnerabilities in the administration. I mean, we saw the case of the GSA officials out in Las Vegas. We've had missing money in agencies here and there. And also the embarrassment, although it does not seem to be anything other than a health-related matter, of Commerce Secretary John Bryson, who had these traffic accidents out in California, apparently because of having suffered some sort of a seizure. And he has now, as of Thursday, resigned as the Commerce Secretary. Not really a scandal, but also just one of those moments
another
where the administration
headache.
To explain. And all of this, of course, is grist for the campaign, grist for the Romney campaign against Obama. And the Romney campaign against Obama is up and running. They closed the cash gap. With the money that they've just raised, they raised more money in the last month than the agglomeration of all of the different Obama-linked committees, and they're on the march.
Yeah, but there was something interesting, very odd that happened this week regarding the Romney campaign. There was a report first broadcast by ABC News, later by the Washington Post, that said that basically Marco Rubio, the freshman senator from Florida, is not being vetted. He has not been asked to turn over any documents regarding a possible vice presidential nomination. And so that became big news in Washington because what does this mean? I mean, first of all, in the week that both Romney and Obama are talking to Naleo, and immigration and Latino politics is coming into everybody's focus. The one Latino Republican who's on everybody's shortlist, Marco Rubio, is not going to be vetted.
Do you believe that report was wrong?
I do believe it was wrong.
You think he was being vetted the same as Rob Portman, the same as any number of other people?
Well, first of all, the Romney campaign is keeping this very close to the vest, and they're really not talking about who's being vetted and who's not. But the fact that it forced Mitt Romney the next day to come out and say, oh, no, that's not true. Marco Rubio is being vetted.
Absolutely vetting. And, I am absolutely vetting.
And so one, obviously he may be fearful of a reaction from Latino groups or the Tea Party or whatever, but does this mean that every time the name of a potential vice presidential running mate is not going to be mentioned, does that mean that Romney has to come out and say, oh, no, that's absolutely not true?
Probably not.
It just seemed like it threw the Romney campaign for a loop. They don't want to talk about their internal discussions about who's going to be up on the ticket. And by saying absolutely that Marco Rubio is part of this list, it just opens them up to, well, what about Kelly Ayotte? Well, what about Susana Martinez? What about Rob Portman? Everybody else?
That's right. Well, of course, the easy way to do this is you just take a long list of 10 or 15 or 20 names, everybody who's been mentioned at any point or any juncture in time, you know, Rick Santorum, Newt Gingrich, who cares, anybody, and just ask them all.
Hiram Fong.
Ask them all for their documents. Get their pay stubs. Find out if they can get a reference from one of their grade school teachers. Do the whole nine yards. Get everything you can about them. And just ignore the ones you aren't really interested in. The crazy thing is that apparently nobody had actually asked Rubio for the kind of documents that people would be assuming. And so in all likelihood, somebody in the Rubio operation had said, well, no, nobody's asked us for anything when some reporter asked. So that reporter went out and said he's not being vetted, which might not be true. He may be on somebody's short list, but they probably also hadn't asked him for the documents. Therefore, the story gets going, and Romney has to come out and embarrass himself, as you described.
But do we know for a fact that everybody who is on this shortlist have been asked for documents?
No, we don't, but that's not what was reported. Right, right. What was reported was that Rubio hadn't been,
and that
might not be wrong.
And it also came in the very week that Mitt Romney would not like to go before the American public and say, the big Latino name, Marco Rubio, is not on my shortlist.
Especially when they haven't decided what their position is on the latest challenge that's been thrown at them by the president. You know, the interesting thing about Rubio is he's the senator from Florida, so that's got to help you in Florida.
True.
He is also Hispanic, as we have noted. He's a descendant of Cuban immigrants, and he is a huge Tea Party favorite. It's a little surprising to some people the degree to which he got his big boost in Florida, not from being Hispanic, but by being the champion of the Tea Party in that state in 2010. So we're really talking here about a lot of different assets this man has. Of course, he's only 40 years old. He's new in the Senate. There may be other reasons not to consider him for vice president, but he has a unique trifecta of assets, and the Tea Party remains, while maybe we don't talk about it as much as we did for a while there in 2009 and 2010, it remains an enormously important part of the Republican base, and we're seeing that in Orrin Hatch's extraordinary performance out in Utah. Utah's having its primary next week. And Orrin Hatch looks like he's going to survive where, you know, his colleague from Utah lost his job in the Senate in the last go-around.
Robert Bennett, right. And also his colleague in the Senate, also 36 years in the Senate, Dick Lugar from Indiana lost this year. But the difference between Orrin Hatch and Dick Lugar, and Robert Bennett to some extent, is that Hatch seemed to have learned the lesson that Lugar refused to listen to and that Bennett ignored as well. And that was, if there's a potent challenge from the Tea Party, I'm not going to give them the opportunity to say that I'm soft on conservatism. So while Lugar basically told the Tea Party to go jump in the lake, to his detriment, that Robert Bennett didn't take the thing seriously until it was too late, Hatch did from the beginning, and his challenge, Dan Lilienquist, a former state legislator who's running in Tuesday's primary, has been outspent and outworked by this 78-year-old Orrin Hatch.
Yes, as you say, right from the beginning. Orrin Hatch didn't wait to see who his 2012 opponent was going to be from the Tea Party. He went to Tea Party
meetings.
Right, they
thought it was going to be Jason Chaffetz, the congressman.
That's right. But even before the primary, even before we got anywhere near 2012, Orrin Hatch was going to Tea Party meetings to which he had not been invited, walking in and saying, I'm going to impress you with just how much I'm willing to listen to you, how I take you seriously. And he was undermining whatever candidate might run against him in 2012. And he's going to reap the harvest for that diligence next Tuesday when he gets renominated.
As long as Hatch has been in the Senate, and as I said, since 1977, Charlie Rangel of New York has been in Congress even longer. First elected in 1970, defeated the legendary Adam Clayton Powell in the Democratic primary. So he's been in Congress basically almost 42 years. And, you know, we always say about Charlie Rangel that he has these nine lives. He was censured by the House in December of 2010 for campaign irregularities.
He lost his chairmanship of Ways and Means.
And so here he is battling for another term. He has a tough battle. There's a guy, a state senator by the name of Adriano Espaillat, who is Dominican-American. He would be the first Dominican-American ever elected to Congress. And when Charlie Rangel was first elected in 1970, first of all, it was Harlem-based, and it was three-quarters African-American. Much of the district has moved on to the Bronx and Hispanic areas, Puerto Rican, Dominican, and Rangel, 82 years old, slow of step, with ethics problems against him. He could be in a big, big, tough battle. Now, the thing that's good for Rangel is that there were two opponents on Tuesday's ballot. The third guy, for some reason, has been endorsed by the New York Times. But it's something to watch whether Rangel can survive, because he is the second longest serving African-American in history. Matter of fact, the longest serving African-American in history is John Conyers of Michigan, who also has a tough battle in the August primary because of redistricting. He may even lose to a white candidate. That's how much that district in Detroit has changed over the years.
Down in Florida, a former senator, although he was an appointed senator and a briefly serving one, George Lemieux, had hoped to get back to the Senate as an elected senator this year, but he has dropped out of the Republican primary.
Right. First of all, the problem is, for him, that the party seems to have coalesced behind Congressman Connie Mack. Connie Mack refused to debate any of his Republican opponents, saying his real focus is Bill Nelson, the Democratic incumbent. George Lemieux said, look, you know, I have no chance in this, and I'm dropping out. But another problem from Lemieux from the beginning was that when he was appointed to the Senate for 16 months in 2009, he was appointed by Charlie Crist, who then was the Republican governor, but who was running in a primary against Marco Rubio, quit the Republican primary, and his name is really dirt in the GOP.
So it all comes back to Marco Rubio in one sense or another. Dave Weldon, a former congressman, is running down there too, but it really does appear as though the party's consolidated behind Mack, and he'll be Bill Nelson's opponent in the fall. And in Ohio, a House race that is probably not going to be a close contest, but which will nonetheless be much watched, because their veteran Marcy Kaptur, the Democratic nominee in a much redrawn district in northern Ohio,
centered in Toledo,
is being opposed by a fellow by the name of Samuel Wurzelbacher,
or
known as
Joe the Plumber.
Yes.
Now he is taking an old line that pro-gun groups have been using forever, basically saying that gun control has caused the Armenian massacre, and even went so far to say that...
Permitted it. I mean, that if the Armenians had been permitted to have guns, they could have defended themselves. If the Jews in Germany had had guns, they could have defended themselves against the Holocaust.
So basically, that seemed to have been a little bit too much for several people. Not that he was going to beat Marcy Kaptur anyway, but it may have been a campaign tactic a little bit too far.
And a quick note, saying goodbye this past week to ex-Representative Norm Lent of New York, who beat Al Lowenstein back in 1970.
Yeah, what was fascinating about Norman Lent, he was a moderate Republican who was in Congress for 22 years. He finally retired in 1992, but he got national attention when he beat Al Lowenstein, who was one of the guys behind the Dump Lyndon Johnson movement in 1968. But Lent himself turned out to be a very pro-environment Republican in his 22 years in Congress. And again, somebody who talked across the aisle, worked with Democrats, believed in compromise. He was still a conservative, but again, the kind of compromise that Norman Lent practiced in those 22 years, you don't see that often in Congress today.
Someone from the old school, now closed. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. Come together.